You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Well, welcome. Thanks, everyone, for being here. I'm Rich Reifel. I'm on the finance faculty at the Olin Business School at Washington University in St. Louis. This is our final panel, as I mentioned. It's going to be a little bit different format. It's going to be just a discussion, so we won't be having any formal presentations. I won't introduce the panelists in any detail because their bios are in the handout that you got when you registered. We are scheduled to go to 5:15, and I'll try to get us out of here on time, and we will have some time at the end for audience questions and panelist answers. I will, as Dan did, remind everybody, since this is being streamed, if you ask a question, if you would state your name and your affiliation, and I would remind everybody, as I learned in English class long ago, a question is usually short with a clause or two, followed by a question mark, okay, and maybe some uptalk. So if we could limit our questions to actual questions. So for those of you that were here for the last panel, they spoke a lot about pensions. So this will be continuing in that theme. And I imagine that our dinner speaker tonight might have a thing or two to say about pensions as well. So I'm looking forward to that. We heard in the last panel about risk sharing and risk transfer and this notion of generational equity. We heard about funding targets. I left feeling pretty good about pension funding. I won't be eligible for a pension from any entity, but I felt pretty good about it. I like that discussion of funding targets. We heard a little bit about opportunity costs. So this panel is going to talk about another tool to bring up funding levels in pensions, and that is payment in kind for state and local pensions. And our panel will discuss whether or not that's a good idea, when it's appropriate, and when it isn't. And the panel reads a little bit like one of those bad jokes. There was a lawyer, an actuary, an academic, and a politician, but we're not stranded on a desert island. We're on a panel here at Brookings, so I'm looking forward to that. We have Mike Imber, Todd Towser, Jonathan Steinberg, and Laura Quinby, who you just heard in the last panel. So with that, we'll get started. So if we're going to talk about payment in kind, I thought it would be good if we first had a working definition of what we mean by payment in kind. So we're going to ask Mike to give us that working definition and get us started.
Thank you, Richard. Basically, a government can use a hard asset or the fair market value of a hard asset and contribute it to the pension and use that fair market value to offset the unfunded liability. And this actuaries will take into account when they're calculating the catch-up payment and your normal cost payment, and it can have an immediate impact on what you have to budget in the general fund. And a government could contribute assets that are not essential to the delivery of government services. You could contribute cash-flowing assets like a lottery or a hospital or a stadium or a nursing home that, if it has a positive cash flow, that can help liquidity situations for underfunded pensions. Or you could contribute non-cash-flowing assets like raw land or buildings that governments are using but they're underutilizing them and there's no cash flow associated with them. And these contributions could be made either directly to the pension fund itself or, as we explored in Connecticut, you'll hear about in a few minutes, contribute to a trust that is beneficially owned by the pension.
All right, excellent. So we've got a working definition now. So we'll continue with Mike to tell us some of the benefits of these kinds of transactions, and you mentioned that You've got some specific experience in Connecticut and elsewhere, but if you could talk about some specific examples and what made them successful or not as successful as people had contemplated going into it.
Okay. So I think the opportunity here is to unlock the hidden equity value of assets that sit on the government's balance sheet for the benefit of the pensions. And if you were to contribute a currently cash-flowing asset, like a lottery, that helps solve your liquidity problem. At the same time, it can take resources away from other expenditures that are in the general fund budget. So I often use the metaphor, it's kind of like shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic. You get a dedicated stream, but you've made things worse for yourself somewhere else in the budget. If you contribute a non-cash flowing asset, let's say, for example, in Connecticut, we're holding raw land that we've had on our balance sheet since, say, the 18th century. It's got minimal value, but if I contribute it to the trust and I put solar cells on it, I could sell a concession and enhance the value and create a cash flow where there wasn't one. To come to your part of the question, Richard, about where has this ever been done successfully, I'll go to Queensland, Australia. Some of you may be familiar with the Queensland motorway example, where about 10 years ago, the state of Queensland had an operating budget deficit, and the government contemplated selling as a one-shot major infrastructure assets, including the Queensland motorway. There was public pushback saying, don't do that. So what they did was they got creative and they contributed the toll road directly to the pension fund. And at the time of the contribution, they got a $3 billion credit against the unfunded liability of the pension. And then the government hired professional managers to improve the operation and maintenance of the toll road. And then they actually lengthened the toll road. And then 5 years later, sold the toll road out of the pension fund to the private sector for $7 billion. So they got a $3 billion credit that they didn't have before, and then they unlocked $4 billion of new value, all for the benefit of the pension. That's an example of a big example of success elsewhere in the world. A little closer to home for Jonathan and me, because we're both from Connecticut, the city of Hartford a couple of years ago took a slice of parkland that it had, Batterson Park, and contributed it to the pension. They took a $5 million credit against what they otherwise would have funded. Whether or not Hartford did it correctly remains to be seen, but it's been done. An example of an asset that could have been used to the benefit of pension, but political interests, I think, superseded it, is the example of the Philadelphia Gas Works. About 5 years ago, I like it when Josh is smiling at me. About 5 years ago, Mayor Nutter in Philadelphia had a buyer, strangely from Connecticut, it was UIL, teed up to buy Philadelphia Gas Works, a city-owned utility, for $1.9 billion. And they were going to use that money to pay down legacy debt. They were going to make a downstroke of several hundred million dollars against the pension. And there were a number of reasons that city council ultimately said no. One was the mayor ran a bad process of communication with city council. But the lesser known reason is that many of the patronage jobs that city council controlled was at Philadelphia Gas Works. And city council wasn't really willing to give that up. So part of the construct that we were examining in Connecticut with the legacy obligation trust idea is that by putting assets into a trust, having them professionally managed by somebody other than the government, you would incentivize a manager to maximize economic utility over political utility, because it is an underlying premise, as far as I'm concerned, that when governments manage capital assets, they seek to maximize political utility over economic utility.
I'm wondering if I could put Jonathan on the spot and ask, compare that political utility versus that economic utility and some of those considerations.
Well, I think Mike hit it on the head. When people ask me the motivation behind the decision-making process with regard to the Connecticut state budget, my response is always desperation. For over four decades, you can almost say 7 or 8 decades, Connecticut chose to effectively ignore the actuarial required contributions, treating them more like actuarial you really ought to think about contributions for too long, and grossly underfunded its pension ratios and created gigantic unfunded liabilities, which has been a dominant factor in our budgeting in the state for many years. Combine that with a weak economy going into the recession, the loss of our manufacturing economic base in the 80s, and the impact of the recession itself, many of the things we've heard talked about, out-migration, forced choices that undermine essentiality. If you look at our pension obligations, our debt service, our Medicaid expenses, it's now approaching 50% of the entire budget, those fixed costs, crowding out other things. So when Mike presented this concept of the Legacy Obligation Trust to a group of from the Finance Committee of the legislature, I jumped on it because I don't want to say I was interested in it because I was desperate, but because we needed fresh ideas on how we could go about it. And on paper, Connecticut had over 3,000 real estate assets, the lottery aside, which we also looked at, which in theory could be contributed to the pension funds and improve the funded ratio. So we were very intrigued by it. We created a pension sustainability commission, a little bit of a misnomer. We were only really focused on the lot concept and not necessarily on other considerations. But it was an opportunity to evaluate the prospect of something that hadn't really been done on a statewide basis. We discovered that, as you might expect, not all assets are treated equally. Some of them were postage stamp size, DOT right-of-ways, and some of them were very large properties, campuses for hospitals, universities, airports, that each had their own special, unique collection of entanglements that made it very difficult to treat them necessarily as easily eligible assets. And our conversation over a period of about 8-9 months really focused on those two aspects, eligibility of the asset and determining whether or not they could really be contributed, and secondly, valuation. You heard Mike talk about current market value, but you have to think about upside. You have to think about additional costs related to making that asset more eligible, some of them legal costs. And it got much more complicated than you might imagine, which led us at the end of our very limited mandate with our very limited resources to come up with a non-conclusion conclusion that this required further evaluation with adequate resources to actually do some of that valuation analysis. But we were very effective at least in determining criteria for evaluation, both in terms of the eligibility and the valuation. So, we've kind of issued a report. This is like volume one. Looks very impressive. But we've kind of kicked it to the Office of the Treasurer. We have a new treasurer after the most recent election. That's something they ought to consider because there was a lot of back and forth about whether or not we should create an independent trust entity, a trust manager, or keep it within the aegis of the treasurer's department and the various investors they already had. There were issues of liquidity. There were issues of control that were a great concern. And Connecticut is a state in which the unions, the state unions, have perhaps undue influence, maybe starting to change a little bit. It made it very complicated for us to talk about the political equity issues in the way that Mike alluded to.
Thank you. And I think you coined a new term, an ask, an actuarially suggested contribution. So in the last panel, a couple of people made this point about the need for government to continue its mission while it's also trying to fund pensions, and I thought that was an interesting discussion, the trade-off and the tension thereof. So, and Mike has alluded to two different types of assets, some that can be contributed in kind that have an asset value versus an ongoing cash flow value. So, Laura, could you give us some background and some framework for analysis and determining why would I look at an in-kind contribution that would be kind of a one-time shot versus something that would be a cash flow producing asset, and how might I view those two differently?
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to weigh in on this. So at the Center for Retirement Research, we almost always prefer to see governments contributing cash to their pension funds, and we discourage transfers of assets in kind. So I'm starting from the premise that most state and local governments are going to consider transferring assets when their plans are very poorly funded. And given that premise, my main concern is that governments will forego the traditional cash contributions in favor of risky assets in kind that are illiquid and hard to value. So why do I consider these to be so risky? Well, first of all, most state and local pension trustees do not have the expertise to directly manage assets like lotteries or toll roads, even assets that are producing an income stream already and don't need to be developed. Nor does their administrative staff have this expertise. For example, among the plans in the PPD, 54% of trustees are plan participants. So that means in a teacher's plan, for example, half of the trustees are going to be current or former teachers. And so acquiring the necessary expertise to manage these assets could distract pension fund managers from earning the best risk-adjusted return on their portfolios. And some work that we've done has consistently shown that the worst funded plans already earn below average returns on their portfolios. So second, indirect investments, such as a state-run government trust, can also be highly risky. So it's not hard to imagine a scenario playing out as follows. The trust would value the assets, which would then be placed on the pension fund's balance sheet. And since government assets are notoriously hard to value, the potential for political influence here seems high. Once the assets are on the balance sheet, the pension would appear better funded on paper, allowing the actuary to calculate a lower annual required contribution, which in turn would allow the government to reduce its cash contributions to the fund, which is probably the true objective. But pensions actually need cash to pay the benefits. Being well funded on paper isn't enough. So if the valuation of the asset turns out to be incorrect or the assets turn out to be difficult to monetize, then the pension fund could easily face a liquidity crisis. And so for these reasons, I believe that pension funds in financial difficulty are better served by cash contributions or by dedicated revenue streams than by sort of transfers of assets that require development. That said, I am sympathetic to creative attempts to raise revenue, and it seems likely that some government assets could be developed to generate new revenue while still maintaining the government's core mission of providing public services. And designating specific sources of revenue that are earmarked to pay down legacy unfunded liabilities does help governments commit to a sound funding discipline. So in other words, to answer the overall question, I would prefer that governments develop their assets and broaden their revenue base as much as possible holistically, but then just commit cash to the pension fund.
So Todd, you've done a lot of work in this area as well. Do you have some differing views on the approach to selecting assets and this notion of a one-time hit versus an ongoing benefit and cash generation?
Yeah, so I'll give 20 seconds real quick on my background just to enlighten the perspective that I'm coming from. For many years, I was an internal pension actuary for CalPERS, and in the end there, I actually worked on developing policies that would end up being whether or not they would be sustainable for pension plans over time. So that was the focus of the work. And then I was hired by S&P to go out and evaluate the health of pension systems, but then tie that into the cost pressures for state and local governments. And then finally, recently, I moved into a consulting role for pension systems across California. So my point here is that even though I've had different employments and quite different work engagements across the way, the blessing to me is that my perspective has been able to stay very much the same. And that perspective is evaluating what's the most sustainable, prudent, healthy for retirement systems over time. So that's the perspective that I'm bringing here. And in order to answer the specific question in terms of transferring assets and the kind of assets, I think it's first important to call back to a previous panel that talked a lot about the disparity of pension health funding across the United States. It's extremely true that, and probably everyone in this room would agree that pension funding has varied greatly, but I think it's important to dig into why pension funding has been so different across the United States. And to do that, it's really important to understand funding discipline, a term that Laura just mentioned. It was mentioned a little bit in the previous panel, but from my analysis and my background, I've learned very much that funding discipline is essential to the great divide of plans that are doing well versus plans that are doing poorly. And what I mean by funding discipline is, first of all, the assumptions that go into valuing the liabilities, those being prudent and realistically evaluating the liabilities, and then the actual contributions, that the contributions would be effective at dealing with unfunded liabilities and that they would be consistent over time and met in full. And so once you get past funding discipline, then you can start talking about asset transfers and solutions to throw things into the pension system. But if the funding discipline isn't there, if contributions aren't being made, you're going to find that any of these other solutions are more temporary and ineffective in nature, because there's going to be, in addition to all the headwinds we already talked about in terms of life expectancy and market returns and all these other things, the plan sponsors to the pension systems can create their own headwinds just by having poor funding discipline that can create a huge drag on the position that they're able to achieve over time. So with that, assuming that there has been some matter of addressing the pension funding discipline issue, then we can get into talking about different kinds of potential asset returns. From my perspective, of course, assets that don't produce ongoing revenue streams are more of a small kind of band-aid on large challenges. That not only do they not produce benefit streams, but they're typically pretty small compared to pension liabilities. And even as Jonathan mentioned, in terms of eligibility or other kinds of requirements, they can be highly limited. But once we get into ongoing revenue streams that can actually generate revenues over time and can be compounded and developed, I think there's a lot more potential there for the development of assets over time for pension systems. But at the same time, there's also a lot more potential for temptation, for things to go awry, which I think Laura was also alluding to before. And so that's one of my bigger concerns as well. Typically, what we saw, at least when I was at S&P, is governments that had future dedicated revenue streams, they would reach out, try to grab all those future revenue streams, bundle them today, count them as an asset today, increase the funded status today, and lower the required contribution. And that ended up seeming to be one of the primary goals for these. And so additionally, what Laura said earlier was governments that are considering this are often the ones that have shown poor funding discipline in the past. So they've already dug a big hole for themselves today, and they've done that by deferring contributions into the future and lowering contributions today in the past. They've lowered contributions. So then when there's a new solution that comes, and with it, it says, oh, you can lower contributions today, you can have budgetary relief because of these new assets. That should be a huge red flag. It makes no sense to win in the middle of a deep ditch to try to lower contributions with a solution. Instead, the alternative is to have contributions be met in full and continually over time. And then on top of that, if there are revenue streams that are identified, to have those come in on top of the contributions, supplement those contributions, and help these systems dig out of those huge holes that they're in currently. And that kind of solution is one in which over time will be much more sustainable and actually will provide much more budgetary relief. So it's not just the health of the pension system we're talking about. We're talking about budgetary relief for the plan sponsors, for the governments behind those pension systems.
If I could just add, what you just described at the end is the state of Connecticut. For the past 10 years, we have shown discipline. We have been making the annual contributions, but the liability is so large, we can't make that up with limited revenue because the state just doesn't have it, which is why we're looking at non-cash-based assets.
So, you know, over the years, there always seemed to be some innovation, whether it's around pensions or other municipal finance innovations. I'm thinking of pension obligation bonds and privatization and whatnot, and this seems to be another one of those instances. So I'm curious, maybe we just quickly go down the panel. Is this really a thing? Is this going to sweep the country? Is everyone going to be looking at this? Are we likely to see a lot of this going on? Or, you know, notwithstanding all the perceived benefits, and you've done a great job of outlining some potential pitfalls, are we going to see a lot of this? Are we going to continue to see more of it if the market continues to be as strong as it has? What's your prognostication for this?
I think more governments are going to consider it. Illinois has formed a specific task force to look at in-kind asset contributions. New Jersey has hired an asset advisor to evaluate assets for potential contribution following the lottery. I think that there are some governments, states, and cities, and some counties that are so deep in the hole that they cannot grow their way out, they can't tax their way out, they can't cut their way out, and they can't borrow their way out. And the only way you're going to be able to turn and move the needle is if you change the equation and add something to the numerator on funding. And I acknowledge all of the risks that Laura and that Todd have identified, and we don't have time to go into it today, but the Legacy Obligation Trust construct addresses many of those. And I think that there is potential here. But critical, and I just want to bring up one point that Laura brought up, hiring an outside professional manager is absolutely critical to unlocking the hidden equity value. And this idea alone is not a silver bullet. It has to be done in the context of real pension reform, like Todd was talking about, and funding discipline.
Just on the topic real quick of the ongoing revenue streams over time, it's not really a new topic. The lot construct that you're talking about here is more of a new topic, but all over the place, state and local governments have considered dedicated revenue streams to put into pension systems, or to take the revenue from them, put them into the pension systems. And that's where we've had examples in the past of misuse of those revenue streams in terms of actually using them to lower contributions and digging themselves actually into a deeper hole while claiming that they were finding solutions for the pension systems. At its extreme, there was a case, I think this was the state of California, actually maybe 30 years ago or so, where in the pension valuation, they would look at the future employer contributions from the state, bring them all to today and count them as an asset and list the state as 100% funded today because of the actual contributions that were going to make it 100% funded in the future. So, I mean, it just goes to show you have to be very careful. New ideas and new solutions are a very good thing, but the way that you go about doing it has to adhere specifically to the concept of funding discipline and what we're talking about here.
So you heard a lot use of the word discipline, and I think that also describes what the future of the law concept is going to be. We need to establish a discipline, particularly municipalities, many of which have very low funded ratios, can look at it as a standard so that it's easier to identify appropriate assets. And they do it on a more strategic basis than on a global basis. They're able to identify those assets, measure the upside, figure out what it's going to take. And then, as Mike said, I think you're not going to have the inside resources to manage those kind of things. So I think that there will be a growth of organizations prepared to help government figure out how to take advantage of these limited opportunities where they present themselves. So I think this needs to be on the radar screen for government at every level when they start thinking about ways in which they can enhance the revenue stream, but they're going to have to be strategic about it. It's not going to be a global fire sale of assets, which is actually very problematic. It's going to be much more limited.
So my short answer to the original question is I hope not. The long answer is that often when we look at governments that are facing pension financial difficulties, it's not just the pension that's in trouble, it's the whole budget that's structurally imbalanced. And you can't just blame the pension for the trouble. The government's going to need to get creative about generating revenue or about reassessing its expenditures across many different domains, pensions included. And so given that, as I mentioned before, we support the idea of thinking creatively about how do we generate revenue from assets that are perhaps underdeveloped right now and that could be better developed. But there's no necessarily any reason to link that directly to the pension system. The pension shouldn't be managing these assets. It should just receive cash. That's my position.
Why don't we look to the audience to ask a question? And the first hand up is Tim Coffin over there. Thank you. Thank you. Could you wait for the microphone, stand up, state your affiliation and your name, and end with a question mark, please, Tim.
How do you do? I'm Tim Coffin with Breckenridge Capital Advisors, and I want to ask the philosophical question, I guess, to Jonathan, which I'm sure you've wrestled with. First of all, Mike, I disagree with your term hidden equity. What you're talking about is generations of equity. It's been in front of everybody the whole time, and you're talking about tapping into it today. I guess my question philosophically, and you must have wrestled with this at the political level, is these are entities that were never intended to make money. They are intended to serve a public purpose. And so to transfer them into an investment pool, they're going to have to start making money, which was never their intention. Have you discussed that, and how have you wrestled with that?
It's a good question. You know, when you talk about thousands of assets, they all have their own stories to them. Some of them are simply office buildings the state acquired in order to house its state employees, sometimes in expensive market-growing areas like maybe downtown Hartford, which is actually starting to come around a little bit. Those employees could perform their function of government for the public good in other less expensive places. So that, there's one argument. Some properties have been donated or were not necessarily in growing areas, but suddenly the economic environment surrounding them has changed, and their potential value has increased along those lines. And you know, I didn't use the phrase hidden equity, but the concept that these properties could be on a government's books and not having been reevaluated over a period of decades could mean that there's an undervaluation. So it's a combination of, are they effectively valued at current market? And what is the upside potential that may reflect changes that are going on in the economic environment around them? So, you know, and to Mike's example, sometimes you just take a small piece of property, put some solar panels on it. It wasn't looked at as anything that could generate income before, but suddenly now it's making a small contribution. When you're in a deep hole, every little bit helps. And in Connecticut's case, we have to be creative along those lines. I think the bigger issue is identifying properties that are worthy of the investment of analysis and management to really pay off on the other side.
So let's say we hold our nose and come up with a scenario where there is an asset that the pension crisis creates the political cover, you know, to do something with that asset that might actually be beneficial. And now you're looking to create discipline. If it were, you know, the states can require localities to have discipline, but there's really nobody who can require the state to have discipline, except maybe bond covenants, which Connecticut has done before. So my question to you is really, you've got a fix-it-for-all solution, and you've got a bond, or is there some other mechanism? What mechanisms can you use to enforce discipline upon a state, okay, and do the bond covenants do it or not?
I would argue that even Connecticut has tried to get around its bond covenants with its teacher pensions, and we just re-amortized to kick the can further down the road to smooth out those annual payments. So nothing short of a constitutional structure can't be undone again. And frankly, we always build in some triggers that allow you to undo those as well. So, you know, you're the one who worked with politicians for 15 years. You ought to know that we always leave a back door. There's always a way to get around it. But, you know, I think, you know, you need a little fear of God when you're in as deep a hole as we are. Suddenly that's a reason for a little bit more discipline. And I think practicing discipline breeds more discipline. We need to get into a habit of doing so. Connecticut's the land of steady habits. For a long time, that was the land of bad decisions. But now, hopefully, we're on the right path.
I also think, just to add to that, now when you look across the U.S., plans are more spread out than ever before. And so you can go back and you can see why they've gotten so spread out. And so there's a lot more information on choices and what has been done poorly, what has been done well. And even politicians can potentially learn from those choices. And the deal is, if they don't learn, pension unfunded liabilities are extremely, extremely expensive. So the longer they carry them and just hold them and defer dealing with them, the more expensive it is for their budget, and they have to see the ramifications of the choices that they've made.
I always thought Connecticut
the nutmeg state, but it's the land of steady habits. Chris?
Hi, I'm Chris Berry from the University of Chicago Harris School. And first, thanks for this panel. It's really educational, and I appreciate hearing different sides of this. And for the kind of advocates of this approach, I feel like there's one step in your argument that's missing, or you're not telling us, you're kind of keeping behind closed doors here. So to just go back to the exchange we had between Laura and Jonathan, take this plot of land that you could plop some solar panels on it and cause it to start generating revenue. Laura's just saying, yeah, well, then why not just give that cash that comes from that to the pension fund? Why do you have to transfer the ownership of the land itself to the fund? And the only argument I could really think of is we are trying to tie the hands of the politicians and give it a dedicated stream of revenue that they can't send somewhere else, because it's always very tempting to take this new money and spend it on something maybe more visible to the voters. But what's the reason why you need to transfer the ownership as opposed to just earmarking the revenue? Is it something else?
There is a reason, and it's if you transfer the asset to a trust. Let me back up. If you transfer the asset straight to the pension fund and you're successful in generating cash flow out of that asset, terrific. But the big cash comes when you sell the asset later and you capture the accreted value. So basically, you've got one exit strategy for creating liquidity. If you contribute the asset to a trust, and the ownership of the trust is represented through certificates of trust that are issued to the pension fund like shares of stock, and you develop the asset in the trust, like a specialized REIT, for those of you who know what a real estate investment trust is. If you professionally manage the asset in that trust, you still have a cash flow that's being generated that can be sent as a dividend to the certificate of trust holders, that is the pension fund. And in terms of creating an exit strategy, the trust affords you two exit strategies. One is an outright sale of the asset out of the trust, or if it's generating a nice cash flow every year, like a dividend, and let's say we did this in Connecticut, Yale comes along with its endowment fund and says, I really like the look of those certificates that you hold there, pension fund. I like the dividend. I like the direction that the state is going. Would you sell some of those shares to us so that we can hold it in the endowment fund like an investment? So there's two exit strategies that the lot concept affords you. And by the way, nobody's implemented the lot concept exactly as is. It was born of my experience working on the Detroit bankruptcy. I could tell you a whole backstory on that. But it's all about trying to align the interests of the government with the economy and benefiting, you know, those who are still owed money. So and all of these criticisms, I welcome them, because this is new, it's innovative, and any new idea is going to get rocks thrown at it. So I'm happy to take it all on.
Dan?
Dan Bergstresser from Brandeis, and I'm going to disguise an anti-NIMBY rant as a question. When we think about the realizing value from these properties, what part of the value that is being realized here is coming from potential relaxation of regulation with respect to the use of the property that in a saner world would be of right available to the owner of the property? Without sort of the regulatory structure that prevents the use of its highest value.
My buddy Ben? You want me to answer? Okay, all right. There was a question. Wait, hold on. So to the professor, it is entirely possible that there could be some relaxation of regulations, but the concept hasn't been developed that far. But the thing of it is that the government needs to recognize we've got a really big problem. So if there's some zoning regulations that need to be overlooked to help drive a development, that, you know, you don't put anything into the trust that you don't see the development strategy for. You just don't drop in the garbage and think you're going to get something out of it. There's got to be a plan for every asset that you contribute.
I'll add to that. We do this all the time anyway. If you want to talk about economic development, yeah, we make deals. Some of this real estate could be part of a deal to attract a company to expand or to locate in this state. And by definition, we offer all sorts of incentives. It's a slippery slope. You start really not getting your value out of it. But that's precisely what a state like Connecticut might want to do to promote economic development as well. So I think it's a consideration.
Let me jump in with a corollary question. Do you think that that desire to have development then kind of puts you at odds with, had you been a public holder of that for a public purpose, that creates a different incentive?
Yeah, it creates a different incentive. But the thing of it is, right now, one of the things about the theory of the trust is that if the state is able to realize benefit through relief against the underfunding to this much, and then under professional management, we can take assets and enhance their cash flow capacity, whether they're already cash flowing or not, and make the value this big, it gives the legislature an incentive to create a, call it a pro-business environment that gives you the multiplier effect of, we're going to create more jobs and more tax revenue and grow on the asset side of the equation. There's an alignment of interests because the legislature is seeing the benefits, and they'll do more to increase the value of the assets in the trust.
All right. We're going to kick it over to Ben Watkins back there.
So more of an observation than a question, but from a practitioner
standpoint. So long as it has a question mark at the end of it.
I'll work on that. So I think Laura and Jonathan have it right. I've not seen in the public space, in terms of decision making, the primary motivation is usually to reduce your contribution, right? And so there are a lot of games that get played in terms of getting to that point. And the asset swap is an interesting one, but unless you have a recurring revenue stream, you're really just swapping assets around. You're not really solving the problem, from my perspective. You much like pension obligation bonds, you can add risk to the balance sheet if you want to do that. There's winners and losers in that game by leveraging up and making an investment and hope you earn more than you're having to pay on your debt. And so from the asset swap standpoint, normally those assets, either they're usable assets, utilizable assets. If they generate cash flow, great. There's a positive contribution being made there because you're capturing a revenue stream that can generate cash for the pensioner, the pension system. If not, it's just a surplus asset. And you can sell it and monetize it, or you have to lease it back in some way because you're still using the facility. And so you're really just adding leverage to your balance sheet again. You're just swapping it, trying to capture a revenue stream. So I'm not sure that it's the silver bullet to solve the pension system. We've come a long way in terms of accountability now that it's on the balance sheet. The ironic part about accounting for it now is if you reduce your investment return assumption to something maybe more reasonable, that your liability actually goes up. So my point being that making the required contribution is the best solution to addressing the pension system, and I'm not sure swapping assets around is necessarily going to get you where you need to be.
You don't put any non-cash flowing asset in unless you can envision a future cash flow coming from it if it gets a little bit of work. And to use the Detroit example, early on in the negotiations of the Detroit bankruptcy, and I was representing the certificate of participation note holders who had foolishly financed a $1.4 billion contribution to Detroit's pension fund. Early on in that negotiation, the city offered us all of its owned real estate, which was pretty much dilapidated and probably had negative value. But we developed a model where we said if we took all of that land in Detroit, and it was 22 square miles of Detroit, and dropped it into a trust and brought in new money to remediate the blight, give a preferred return to the new money, and then share in the equity upside with the creditors, we could all benefit. What ended up happening was is that people at that meeting when I presented this idea said, I know how to get our hands on the art museum. And that's what everybody in this room read about in the Wall Street Journal. And then at the end of the case, the art became unobtainable, and my clients ended up settling for real estate. And when Judge Rhodes was reading his opinion approving the plan of reorganization, plan of adjustment, he specifically cited this alignment of interests between the creditor's recovery and the city's recovery. And that was really the basis of the creation of this idea. So you don't put anything into the trust, Ben, unless you can see the exit strategy for it on the back end. If you just drop in the garbage, you're not going to get any value. It's not a one-time thing. The idea is to try and capture the accreted value. Last story, and then I know we're over time. You might all remember a few years back, maybe a dozen at this point, Chicago monetized the Chicago Skyway to close up a budget deficit. And, well, that was a separate deal. But with the Chicago Skyway, Equity bought the deal, and 6 months after it was over, they did a dividend recapitalization and paid themselves $600 million. That was money that Chicago left on the table. They got the apple eaten right off the top of their head. The idea of taking an asset like a Chicago Skyway and dropping it into a trust or any other kind of asset like that is to professionally manage it to capture the accreted value for the benefit of the pension, just like they did in Queensland.
And we are out of time, so thank you to the panel. Thank you for your excellent insights.